Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Have you heard of mind wipes? What about web gloves? What about iView lenses or DNA stamps? What about face recognition doors or age-retarding pills? Or what about the global currency unit? You heard of those things? No? Well, that's probably okay, because those things don't actually exist yet. Or at least, yet. Wait another 50 years, and they may well become the gadgets that we use every day. That is the view of Richard Watson from the Future Exploration Network. He's one of Australia's top futurists. He's also the author of The Future Files, A History of the Next 50 Years. Richard's with us now to tell us if androids really will take over the world. G'day, Richard. Good to talk to you.
Hi, nice to talk to you too.
Will they really take over the world?
Well, there's a bit of a sort of difference of opinion on that. Some people seem to think they will, and some people seem to think not. I'm slightly in the sceptical corner of that. I mean, it's not going to happen in my lifetime, but I think if you give it enough time, it is a possibility.
There's a growing market for future forecasting at the moment. We could say, trend predicting, but I know that you don't like the word predicting, do you, with this whole field?
Oh, I've got used to it. I mean, I think the issue really is there's just such an incredible level of uncertainty and sort of change going on that's what's driving this. Although the great joke here, obviously, is that no futurists actually saw this coming. But no, there is a genuine demand for one reason or another for futurists, or futurologists, as it's more technically correctly called at the moment.
Yes, and big companies are paying big dollars to find out what those trends might be.
Absolutely. So there's something to it. Some very large organisations have futurists on the payroll. McDonald's until recently had a futurist on the payroll. The FBI has a futurist in residence, and some very big sort of electronics companies all have futurists on the payroll as well. And in other people, it's more of a sort of consulting role.
Mm. Well, I wanted to cover three broad areas with you. One, technology; two, social trends; and three, maybe world politics, and just touch on some of those areas that you're looking into the future and seeing what may well happen. Okay, the androids you don't think may well take over the world, but certainly we're moving towards a very robotic or roboticized future, aren't we?
Absolutely. I mean, Japan has been at the forefront of this for quite a long time, for a number of reasons, one of which is they have a rapidly aging population, and there's not enough young people to look after the old people, so they're looking at robots in caring roles, and they've already got childcare robots in development. They've got robotic security guards in shopping malls in Tokyo right now, and they're getting quite sophisticated. The question of whether sort of these robots ever take over the world is really down to the fact that, or whether or not they'll actually develop a consciousness, and this is where there's this big argument. You know, can you actually get a machine to be sort of thinking about itself and its own thinking? And a lot of people say, no, that's ridiculous. And other people say, no, that eventually will come. But they're getting extremely sophisticated. I mean, you're getting robots where you can throw them a ball and they'll catch it. They're obviously sort of more intelligent than humans in very specific areas. I mean, the most obvious example being IBM's Big Blue, which I think was that 97 when it won that chess game against the Grandmaster.
Mm.
I don't think you'll necessarily see a general intelligence from a machine, but I think in specific areas they will be smarter than people probably in about 20, 25 years, which is not all that far away.
Mm.
And they're already, you know, being used for all sorts of things. I mean, dangerous jobs, the transport of dangerous materials and so on. I mean, they're obviously used in manufacturing and have been for a very, very long time, and there are allegedly 7 million robots in domestic roles in homes around the world. I mean, I'm thinking particularly of these things that don't cut your grass very well or don't clean your home very well, that zoom around on their own.
Mm.
And it's getting increasingly sophisticated. The U.S. military recently put together a tender for the largest U.S. military contract in history, and it was for the development of robotic soldiers, which sounds very science fiction, but that's happening. I mean, they don't, unfortunately, at the moment look like Terminator. They look like large Tonka trolls, which is a bit of a letdown. But, you know, again, it is coming, and they're getting increasingly sophisticated.
What might this mean, though, if we've got a whole bunch of these robots running around and you actually suggest they could be smarter than us in 20 to 25 years? What could be the downsides?
Well, you get some fascinating, almost sort of philosophical questions about, you know, if there's an accident in a war with using a robot, who is responsible? Now, theoretically, it can't be the robot because they don't have that sort of level of thinking, so it must be the person sort of behind the robot. You get questions like, you can already have surgery performed by a robot. That's been done. I mean, would you trust a robot to administer a general anesthetic to you and perform surgery? Would you trust a robot to fly a plane with no human pilot. I mean, you get some quite interesting questions around that sort of area.
Absolutely. All right, tell me about web gloves, mind wipes, and DNA stamps.
Right, well, this is my sort of response to people such as yourself constantly asking me about predictions. I eventually decided I would make some predictions. And I did an innovation timeline from 1950 to the year 2050, and it's got obviously genuine innovations up to about 2007-8, and then it becomes purely speculative. Mind wipes were just a rather ridiculous idea that you might have had a very bad day at work, and you come back and you take out one of these pre-moistened wipes, wipe your head, and your day disappears if you've had a particularly nasty one. And the web gloves already exist. I mean, this is so you can actually touch things in virtual worlds that don't actually exist, if you can get your head around that one.
DNA stamps?
Essentially just putting, I think there's I can't remember which country it is, but there are certain organizations that have actually attempted to sort of put DNA traces into products. So if they're ever stolen, there is a DNA stamp on the product and it can be identified back to a specific individual. So that's the sort of theory around that.
That's happening in the art world or something, isn't
yes,
it?
I think so.
Yeah. Putting hairs in and things like that. Yeah. This is Open House Across the Nation. Richard Watson is a futurist and he's the author of The Future Files, A History of the Next 50 Years, the openhouse.net.au for the podcast. Okay, social trends. You talk about five big trends that are going to transform society. Globalization, localization, polarization, anxiety, and meaning. Just touch on those five for us.
Well, I mean, globalization has been a pretty significant trend for quite a long time.
I was kind of surprised it was going to continue on.
Well, there is, I mean, it's interesting you say that because a lot of people assumed actually it was just inevitable it was going to carry on. And we are, in the last year or so, we're beginning to see people question it. And I certainly sort of subscribe to the view it's definitely slowing down. I don't think it could ever go away completely. But, and localization is obviously the counter-trend to that. And with some very big trends, and if you think of them trends in terms of waves, you know, the bigger the wave, you can see it from further away, and you invariably get a sort of counter-trend, which is almost the backwash, or to some extent the rip that goes with it. And the bigger the wave, the bigger the backwash. And localization, to some extent, is a counter-trend to globalization. And people saying, well, actually, you know, I'm interested in supporting my local environment and I want things locally, I'm going to consume locally. And if you factor in oil, which at the moment, you know, again, people getting hysterical when oil was about 150 a barrel and it's now sort of under 40 or something, everyone's forgotten about this, but it will go up back to that price eventually again. And I would have thought that in the short term, that alone would localize manufacturing and consumption because the global supply chains just don't work on $200 or $3, $300 a barrel oil. So I think that's, to some extent, a bit of an inevitable thing.
Okay. So polarization, that's going to be where basically we, half of us go and, adopt all the technology.
Polarization, quite rightly, picked up on it throughout the book as something that's there. I mean, you talk about food getting faster, but then there's this counter trend of it getting slower, and it's polarized between the two extremes. If you think about travel, it's polarizing between, you know, business class, which you're treated like a king or a queen, and the economy, where it's sort of cattle class, and there's not really anything in the middle. And it's well known that within retail, the sort of the middle is pretty much disappeared. You could apply the same argument to education, transport, healthcare. You know, there's the sort of chalk and cheese versions of all of those markets.
Well, even the use of technology, like you're saying, some will adopt the technology, others will kind of revert back to gardening and vintage cars.
Absolutely. I mean, and again, there are generational, particularly if you're talking about technology, there are generational elements to this. So the younger generations tend to be, I mean, I think somebody was talking about digital immigrants and digital natives. You know, you get some people embracing this wildly and thinking it's the best thing since sliced bread, and other people are actually a little bit sort of nervous about the whole thing and unplugging a bit or refusing to use things whatsoever and actually going back to sort of other methods.
Okay, the big trend of anxiety?
Yeah, that's certainly around at the moment. I mean, that's been around quite a while. I mean, I suppose you could argue it's almost been around forever. It's certainly been around since the millennium, and we got all a bit anxious about Y2K, and then 2001 we had a couple of lunatics flying, you know, planes into buildings, which made everyone terribly nervous for quite a long time, and then we had, you know, Bali bombings and all the rest of it. I mean, we had a bit of a panic about deep vein thrombosis on long-haul flights a little while ago, which we all now seem to have forgotten about. Climate change would be a good example, rogue asteroids, global flu pandemics, and to some extent I kind of see the current economic crisis, climate change, in that context. It's the latest focal point for our anxieties, which is not to say that none of this stuff is real, but there is a sort of underlying level of anxiety around. And I think it's a response to, again, the rapid level of change, and nobody really knows what's going on, decline of trust with institutions and all of that kind of stuff. And people are just a little bit sort of edgy most of the time, I think. Yes. Not everybody. I'm not sure that your average 12-year-old is edgy, but I think your average 40-year-old with a family and trying to hold down one or two jobs probably is.
Mm. And then the fifth trend, meaning.
Yeah, I think people are searching for something. They're not quite sure what it is. And again, this is not all people, but I think probably if you said 40 plus, and it's not quite the same as a midlife crisis, but I think people are sort of thinking, well, actually, there's got to be more to it than this. And there's an interest in spiritualism now. And you see this also within organizational context of people seeking jobs that have meaning, where they're making a difference. It is no longer enough for a lot of people to simply earn money. You know, two televisions is quite enough, thank you very much. I don't really need another one. I'd rather, be earning slightly less money and actually be doing something that makes me feel good or makes a difference in some sense.
Yes. Well, I don't know which automobile club it was, but they were actually offering meaning trips, meaning holidays. And the idea was that you took your time off, but you actually went overseas and you did some sort of charitable work.
Well, I mean, that's absolutely. I mean, I think it's Salesforce.com. People give away 1% of their time every year. Within travel, a massive trend is cultural holidays. I mean, it's no longer enough to just lie on a beach and read some trashy novel. People actually want to go and either learn something or help somebody. That's an exploding area of the travel market. The volunteering is growing. All of these sort of things link into that.
Yeah. Now, why are we seeing that growth in? I mean, it's one of those things you could say we've always had, that we've always had that search for meaning. One of the things that makes humans human, we actually want to understand the meaning of things, but why do you think we're starting to see an upsurge in that particular trend of people wanting to have meaningful jobs, meaningful holidays, etc.?
I'm afraid I don't have a good answer to that. I'm still thinking about that. You probably have to go and find somebody more intelligent than I am to answer that and give you a pithy answer. I can't think of a very clever answer.
Is it the downside of consumerism, materialism, where we just find all the material things aren't working for us?
That's what it is. There's an interesting book came out recently called Enough by John Nash, and there's this trend around called enoughism, where people are beginning to question how they live their lives. And this is partly to do with climate change and cutting back. It's partly to do with the pervasive influence of materialism, and people are just sort of questioning things. And it links into work-life balance and happiness and all that kind of stuff. And so it's got something to do with that, but I can't quite put my finger on it at the moment as to what the real reason is.
Yes, okay. All right. Well, Richard, before we go, we need to ask you about the three big ones that have been kind of the cause of the anxiety: water, food, and oil. Where do you see that happening in the future?
I think water is probably the biggest problem the world has, and I think Australia particularly obviously has got an issue with that. We've got rapidly expanding populations, or at least we do have until 2050 when it drops off a cliff for various reasons. Agriculture is becoming more water intensive, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there is the issue of getting enough water. And it's not just that. It's some problems we've had for a long time, like clean water in Africa, which is a massive, massive issue. Oil is clearly a problem, and it's now being talked about. Well, it was talked about quite a lot when it was up about 100, 150 a barrel, something like that. It is going to run out at some point, and we need to find alternatives. But I don't necessarily think that an oil-less world is necessarily a bad world. I think, again, it could localize things, it could sort of strengthen community and all the rest of it. And I'm a great believer in sort of human ingenuity. We will find alternatives, and we will sort things out, renewables and so on. It's interesting, if you go back to the 1700s in Britain, there was a sort of similar crisis around wood, deforestation, rapid growth of cities, and wood was becoming increasingly expensive. Everyone was panicking that they were going to run out of wood, and you've got to remember, this was a wood-based society.
Yes.
At the time, it was the major building material, it was the major fuel, and there was all this sort of fuss. And essentially, because of the high cost of wood, this caused an interest in new technologies, and particularly deep coal mining came out of this, and then obviously other things came around as well. And so we have been here before, and I think we sort of thrive on a crisis in terms of our innovative nature. So I think we'll sort that out, but I think we have a real bottleneck to get through at the moment, in terms of sort of urbanization and rapidly expanding populations. So we'll have to sort that one out. Food, the fundamental problem is rapidly growing populations. Within that, obviously, there are, if you look at China, for example, you have an emerging middle class, or Asia in general, and their diet changes as they get more money. They move away from staples like rice. They start eating meat that is far more intensive in terms of land, water, and so on and so forth. I think it's more a question of how food is distributed and what we consume, rather than saying we're going to run out of food, as a sort of simplistic statement. I don't think that's going to happen at all.
Yeah. And Richard, any trends of the future that you're actually looking forward to?
One of the things I'm not looking forward to, and the plus side of this is the answer to your question to some extent. One of the very big trends is global connectivity, and I'm primarily talking about the internet, but to some extent things like low-cost flights and mobile phones and so on. One of the things I'm not looking forward to is the death of privacy because of the connectivity and digitalization of information. But the plus side of that I am looking forward to is I think the future is a lot more open and truthful, actually, because of this connectedness. It's going to be much more difficult to lie in the future. It's going to be much more difficult to be a bad person and get away with it, or it's going to be much more difficult to keep a secret. Politicians used to hide behind a manipulated image. You'd go on television and you'd have your makeup done, and if you said anything stupid, it was immediately edited by your minders or whatever. These days, if you go and make a small public speech to a private gathering or something, and you say something that's quite controversial, you know, the media is always there because everyone's got a phone with a recorder and a camera, and you will never get away with it. And I think that's an incredibly good thing for the future.
Well, fascinating. We'll see in 50 years' time whether it all comes true. Good to talk to you, Richard.
Thank you very much indeed. Lovely to talk to you.
Yeah, it's Richard Watson, who's a futurist and author of The Future Files, the history of the next 50 years.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.